First, there are a lot of divisions in the United States along the lines of wealth, political belief, race, and religion, to name a few. And on a more basic level, we may be more isolated from one another with fewer opportunities to interact in person with other people in our communities. Our next guest says we can change things for the better by improving what he calls our social infrastructure. That includes things like libraries and parks, even the way we design our buildings and neighborhoods. Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. His new book is Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, when we say infrastructure, we might think of water supplies, highways, railroads, that kind of thing. What do we mean by social infrastructure?
It's a different concept, so it's worth just getting it out there as we start our conversation. I define social infrastructure as the physical places and the organizations, places like YMCAs or churches, that shape our interactions. And the social infrastructure, though we haven't really had a name for it, is just as real as all of those other infrastructure systems you described. We know about it too, because when it's working well, when we take care and invest in social infrastructure, we're much more likely to interact with one another, whether it's a planned occasion or a serendipitous encounter that we have with someone we haven't met. And through those interactions, we're more likely to build communities and even to bridge divisions. But when we neglect the social infrastructure, we become far more likely to hunker down and be on our own. Things start to fall apart then. And unfortunately, I think that's the situation we're in now.
And you've written, the first time I heard your name was, I think I booked you to come on our show to talk about the heat wave in Chicago. This is back in the 90s.
And back when we were young, Rob.
Right, exactly. And this is a case where, because of a lack of social infrastructure, you wrote, a lot of people were isolated. A lot of people died, in effect, because they didn't have this social infrastructure in place in particular neighborhoods in a place like Chicago.
That's right. It's not a luxury. Social infrastructure can be a matter of life or death. And I discovered that when I was doing research for the Heatwave book. I found these neighborhoods in Chicago that looked identical demographically. The number of poor people and old people and people who lived alone was identical from a bunch of paired neighborhoods I put together. And what differed was the death rate. One place would have a death rate that was 10 times the other. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was driving those differences, that the numbers that social scientists usually plug in to figure that stuff out just didn't tell us anything. But what I discovered in the end was it was social infrastructure that mattered. The neighborhoods that had viable sidewalks and active commercial districts, that had churches and neighborhood libraries, those places drew people out into public life and they could support one another. But the neighborhoods that had a lot of empty lots and abandoned buildings, that didn't have a lot of stores and diners and coffee shops, that had broken sidewalks, they made it much more likely that people would wind up home and alone. And in the heat wave, that meant they were far more likely to die. But the amazing thing I discovered, probably after we talked, is that it wasn't just the heat wave that mattered. It turns out that if you live in a neighborhood with a robust social infrastructure in Chicago, you're likely to live far longer, up to 5 years, than if you live in a neighborhood where the social infrastructure has fallen apart. And that's even if everything else is equal. So it's a very powerful force in our lives.
I see sometimes people talk about growing isolation in the United States as kind of a natural process. Well, technology, things have evolved along a certain path. And I think, if I'm reading you right, a key message of your book is there are a lot of choices that have been made and that we could make now that determine whether or not we have these flourishing social infrastructures.
Very much so. And, you know, I had this amazing experience because I live in New York City now, even though I grew up in Chicago and spent a lot of my life in the Midwest. But after Hurricane Sandy hit New York, I was asked by the Obama administration to be the research director for a competition called Rebuild by Design, where we worked with these amazing teams of engineers and architects and landscape architects to come up with 21st century infrastructure projects that could withstand the kinds of threats that well, for instance, that we saw this week or we've been seeing with Hurricane Florence. And when I was working with one of the design teams, they came to me and said, you know, we want to build a resilience center. We have an idea for a place that will be open much of the time, that will have programming for old people and young people and middle-aged people, that will be welcoming, open doors for everyone. And I said, you know, that's a great idea, but it sounds to me like what you're describing is a branch library. And these are places that we could build, or that if we have, that we could do a better job taking care of.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, author of the new book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Let's stay in the library for a minute, Eric. I should disclose I'm married to a librarian, so that's out there. you're a big fan of libraries and the role they play in a community. Expand on that a little.
You are. You're probably going to get a very nice dinner when you come home tonight if we play this one right.
I do most of the cooking.
So I think libraries are a tremendous and largely underappreciated resource in American life. And there is this sentiment that you hear often these days that because we have the internet, you know, because we have Google and we carry machines with us wherever we go in our pockets, we just don't need libraries as much. They become obsolete institutions. In fact, over the summer, Forbes magazine published an article saying we should knock down our public libraries and replace them with Amazon shops. So, you know, libraries have a kind of a bad rap. But when I was taking these design teams after Sandy around the region, I started to look into libraries to see just how they were operating as resilience centers. And I have to say, during a time in which it can feel very dark and scary to be in the United States, I mean, who knows what's going to happen here next, walking into a neighborhood library became a source of inspiration for me. I saw all kinds of activities at all hours of the day, including older people who live alone and are at risk of getting isolated, you know, coming together for virtual bowling leagues in the basements of Brooklyn libraries. That's a program they have there. I saw immigrants coming to study English as a second language or take citizenship classes. I saw young people getting exposed to early literacy programs and kids learning different languages. I saw teenagers coming in after school to do homework. I saw a remarkable range of activities that, for me, illustrate the best of what our country is. And I came to realize that libraries are doing so much more than their critics understand. And really, far from being obsolete, they are the paradigmatic social infrastructure these days. They are places where amazing things still happen, and we neglect them at our peril.
And you write that one fundamental thing about a library is it's a place that isn't your house that you can go spend time in where you don't have to pay, you know, you don't have to buy a coffee or something to have the right to sit there for more than half an hour or so.
I mean, how many places can you think of that open the doors and ask you what they can give you and not what they can take from you? It's such a strange thing if you step back and think about it. We have inherited this idea that everyone is entitled to access, to free access to our shared cultural heritage, and that we should have it in a safe and comfortable place that's going to be open all of the time and probably close to us. This idea of the library, in some ways, it does seem antiquated, because if we didn't have the invention of a library right now, in this moment we live in where everything is based on market value and we think about costs and benefits in this very simplistic way, and we love technology, we love profit seeking, I can't imagine that we would be capable of inventing the library if it didn't already exist. And so I think it's our job, our responsibility, to protect it and to invest in it, and frankly, to update it for the 21st century. Because in addition to those things that I described about the library, it also has become a place of last resort for so many people who slip through the safety net, which now has these gaping holes in it. So I saw lots of homeless people use libraries because it's a warm place and it has a bathroom. I saw people with mental illnesses go to the library because it felt stable and comfortable. I saw people suffering from opioid addiction go to the library because they were counseled to go there by their counselors or by the places where they were getting treatment. And I saw all variety of problems that show up in the library because no one else is paying attention. So if we really want to renew libraries and make them work for 21st century needs, we're going to have to not just grudgingly give them a little bit of a budget to buy new books and fix up the upholstery. We're going to have to think about what it means to reinvent them as vital social infrastructure.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg right now, professor of sociology at New York University. His new book is Palaces for the People. He argues that public spaces, childcare centers, parks, libraries can help reduce polarization and inequality and help bring us together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a community activity, a place in your community where you like to go do stuff with other people, not just maybe even your closest friends or family members? Is there a public space that you feel like you participate in? A library, as he's talking about, a park, a pool, a playground, a baseball diamond, a club? Or do you feel like they're missing? You don't have that place in your community. Do you feel like we're too disconnected from one another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the importance of public spaces and fostering community. Eric Kleinenberg is with us, author of the new book, Palaces for the People. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like people in your community aren't connected maybe the way they used to be or the way you think they were in your parents' or grandparents' generation? Do you have that space, a library, a park, a sports facility, a tavern, where you feel like, hey, people from different backgrounds get together and interact with each other in a good way? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Go to your calls now. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just tell you how much I love our library. The Lake Villa District Library in Lake Villa, Illinois. And I have to tell you, I remember when they were a storefront 40 years ago. So what they're doing is fantastic. I don't know if all of the libraries do this, but people don't even realize what a center they are. If you need to find help, if you need to find an organization, an association, a church, whatever, they keep lists and they will help you find those things. But one of the things that is just astounding now is there's a national movement sponsored by the Foreign Policy Association. And they provide workbooks, which the library has to buy. And the number of people sign up for these once-a-month discussion groups on foreign policy, they can do their own research, but there is a book there, and we do a chapter a month. This is a group of people of varying ages, ethnicities, and believe me, differing political views.
Anita, thanks a lot. I want to jump in there and focus on that last point she made, Eric, because libraries or otherwise, you are worried, and many people are worried, that people of different backgrounds and opinions, as Anita was saying, aren't getting together and talking, and you're hoping that we can revive that.
Yeah, and Anita, I think, gave a beautiful demonstration of all the things that a library can do and things that libraries are doing. We know that too many of us live in an ideological bubble, and we know that we've become more segregated by social class than we have been in quite some time. It can be very difficult when we don't have actual interactions with one another face-to-face to generate civil conversation about the things we disagree on. And if Facebook and Twitter are our primary form of interaction, we will very quickly shout at each other in the most pointless and self-destructive ways. But if you can bring together a group of people who share an interest in ideas in a place like a library or a coffee shop or a playground even, when people are really there to take care of their kids, we get to know each other as people first, and we're then able to enter into a much more humane conversation about the things we value. It's not that we're going to solve the problem of our disagreements, but I think we're able to engage in some civil discourse that gives us a chance of having common purpose. And it's hard not to look at the country as a whole these days and feel that sense of common purpose is really at risk.
Anita, thanks for that call. I want Eric to look at another piece of social infrastructure, but this one, the way you write about it, it's a negative social infrastructure, and that's abandoned buildings. And your chapter on this part of it was excerpted, I saw. Can you talk about abandoned buildings and how they hurt social infrastructure?
Yeah, and I thought a lot about abandoned buildings, having grown up in Chicago in the 1970s and 80s, and I have family in Milwaukee and spent a lot of time there as well, and there's a similar set of issues. Abandoned buildings and empty lots in poor neighborhoods, we now know, aren't just blights. They are also generators of crime. They make it attractive for criminals to use those neighborhoods because they provide a place to hide out or to drop drugs or to find cover. And so there's this group of social scientists and epidemiologists in Pennsylvania who decided to really test this in Philadelphia, where there's more than 40,000 empty lots and abandoned homes. And they did an experiment where, working with the city and a big horticultural society, they randomly selected a set of blocks where they would fix up the empty lots and turn them into simple pocket parks that were well maintained with wood post fences and occasionally little benches. And they'd also board up the houses. And they found that compared to the places that they did not fix up, these treated places generated reductions in gun crime of more than 35%. And what's incredible is that reduction continues to last more than a decade. And the crime didn't just get displaced to other areas. It turns out that crimes come not simply from people who are disposed to commit crime, but also from situations. A lot of our criminal activity is situational. If someone thinks they can get away with something at a moment, they will. But if you change the situation, which you can do by fixing up the social infrastructure, you can actually generate durable reductions in crime. And so I think this is a remarkably fascinating and important finding. There are now cities around the country that are trying to replicate what's happening in Philadelphia. And if it turns out that this is really a pattern, it means we have a tool for reducing crime that is not so punitive, that will not result in widespread discrimination or mass incarceration. And it has the added benefit of not only reducing crime, but also when you fix up depleted places, you also make the quality of everyday life better.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, his new book is Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Let's go to another caller. Gloria is with us in Platteville. Gloria, hi.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for taking my call, and I really like this topic. It's great. I have a question about...
Gloria, you're breaking up. A note from a producer says Gloria is wondering how to get teenagers and children to want to go to the library and make it more appealing. So taking this part of the social infrastructure, Eric, to the next generation.
Well, to be honest, that's not a problem at the national level in the general population. If you go to a branch library at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in almost any community in this country, you will see students rushing in the doors, and younger people are rushing in the mornings with their caretakers, in part because libraries offer all variety of services. There are books for people who want to read books, but a lot of kids are going to libraries because they can get internet access. They're using computers. They're learning computer skills. Some are playing video games. But generally what I observed when I was in New York libraries is that kids were using the video games together in a social way that seems strange to someone of my generation, but seems very natural to them. There are all kinds of programs that libraries host that welcome children and treat them as autonomous, independent, creative people. And in fact, one of the most amazing things I heard from so many people, both young and old, is that their early experiences in libraries, getting their own library card, that's their first card. Sometimes it's the first ID that you get. It gives you this license to make your own choices and take your own responsibility, right? A library book is one of the first things you learn that you have to take care of because it doesn't belong to you. And if you destroy it or don't return it, other people will suffer. It's a great civic lesson. So I will confess that as a father myself, there are days when my kids don't want to go to the library because it seems more fun to go play soccer and basketball. But over time, in the course of things, the library offers a lot of great resources and services, and kids like them too.
Thanks for the call, Gloria. Eric, in our last minute or so, supposing a civic leader, you know, elected official or active citizen, whatever, is listening and says, yeah, I want to boost social infrastructure in my community. Give us a 1 minute first step.
Well, the first thing I would say is look at the places that you already have that could be doing more, whether that's a library or a park that's got an athletic field or a playground that hasn't been updated. There's so many resources that are at our disposal that we could improve if we just invested in them. And the other thing I would say is a lot of cities and small towns have old abandoned infrastructure that once served a purpose and that aren't getting used that much. So think about rail lines that in so many communities have been transformed into bike paths these days and trails, rails to trails programs, or open areas that once had a commercial district that start to fall apart that are renovated for open marketplaces. I think our local leaders and all of us as citizens could be more mindful about how to make places come to life and serve as social infrastructure. It's not necessarily massively expensive, but it's certainly one of the things that we're going to have to invest in when we rebuild our infrastructure, as we have no choice but to do in coming years.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really been my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Eric Kleinenberg, professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Join us to talk about why investing in public spaces can help people create social bonds. If you've got that space like that in your community, like he was just talking about, send us a note, ideas@WPR.org, and tell us about it.